This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Our guest, Cara Nicoletti, was a shy child and an avid reader when she was young, preferring the characters she got to know in the books that she enjoyed to the kids in her neighborhood. Her grandfather, her great-grandfather, her great-uncle were butchers and had a shop in Massachusetts where Cara read and helped out. After getting a degree in English and Latin in 2008 at NYU, she began working in kitchens as a baker and pastry chef, and later as a butcher in Brooklyn, where she lives. She started writing a blog, yummybooks.com, about her twin passions, literature and food, and hosting a supper club at her apartment. Now she's a published author. Her book is Voracious, A Hungry Reader Cooks Her Way Through Great Books. She reread the book she has loved and created recipes inspired by the story. Clam chowder from Moby Dick, buttercream crepes from Gone Girl, chocolate cupcakes with peppermint buttercream frosting from The Corrections. My mouth is watering. And Cara Nicoletti, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. So are people in the food industry readers from what you have experienced?
Yes. A lot of the kitchens that I was working in, it really took me by surprise how much of our time spent in the kitchen cooking was also spent talking about books that we were reading and things that everyone was writing.
Describe the butcher shop that you grew up in. You did work the counter there a bit, and
yeah.
It also sounds like you curled up and read books as well.
Yeah, we spent a lot of – it was my grandfather's shop. Originally, it was his father's shop, and it was in – originally in the north end of Boston and then later on in Newton, Massachusetts. And it was called Sillette's. And I spent, my sisters and my cousins and I spent lots of time there after school doing our homework and reading and playing. And then, you know, sometimes we would work the cash register, but we didn't do any cutting.
You didn't do any?
No.
That was my next question.
No.
But were you surrounded by carcasses
of
animals?
Yeah, and we saw it. Things were in a separate room. We called it, as kids, we called it the stinky room. But so we saw it and we were surrounded by it, but wasn't something that we were allowed to get our hands on.
Well, as you write, and as I said, you were a reader as a kid. So
I was
an early reader, a voracious reader.
Yeah.
Always had a book in your hand.
Yeah, I started reading when I was really young. My dad was an English teacher when I was a kid, and it's always really important to him that we read. So he would read to us every night before bed. My mom would too. And I started reading very young.
How young?
I think probably I was 5.
Yeah,
I don't know if
that's
I actually don't know if that's young.
That's pretty young.
Yeah. But yeah, and I just went from there. I was always reading when I was a kid.
And did you always love food?
I did. Well, my family is, my dad's side is Italian and my mom's side is Jewish. And I think both cultures are pretty food driven and food obsessed. So gathering and eating and cooking together was always something that was important to us. Even just besides having a butcher in the family, it was.
And when you got older, was food in a novel or in a book, did that tell you something about character? I mean, was it a way to understand why characters do and say the things that they do?
Yeah, I think, well, when I was young and I had just started reading, I was focused on the food scenes because, you know, knowing what they were eating and possibly recreating what they were eating made them feel earthly and real to me. But when I got older, I was interested in them also because they do tell you about characters, what a character is eating, who they're eating with, what they don't eat, how they speak to a waiter. That tells you about
a
who
lot.
They are. Yeah, absolutely. And it's the same for life, I think.
Well, I was just going to say, especially how you speak to
how
a waiter.
How you speak to a waiter is a major.
Absolutely. Well, I would love to have you read a section from really the very beginning of your book. It's a chapter. It's titled Childhood. But I think for our listeners, it will give a glimpse of how you were as a kid.
Sure. Okay. One day, while playing the game, I pretended to walk in the door with a dead pig slung over my shoulder, ready to cut up for dinner, just as Paul Wilder does in Little House in the Big Woods. The girls were horrified. "This book is from a long time ago," they said. "People don't do that anymore." I was mortified, mostly because I knew that people, my people, did indeed still do that. After school that day, I paid close attention to my grandfather and great-uncle, the fluid dance of carrying the pigs in from the truck and the focused silence that came once the animals were all on the cutting table, the way their hands changed positions on their knives at the same time in perfect choreography, and I felt proud. As I watched the pigs turn into smaller and more recognizable parts, flipping back through the passages in the book for reference, There were hams and shoulders, side meat and spare ribs and belly. There was the heart and the liver and the tongue and the head to be made into head cheese and a dishpan full of bits to be made into sausage. I saw the bin of tails and briefly imagined asking my grandfather for one to fry over the fire as the Wilder girls did, but the thought made my knees weak, so I decided to focus on the sausage instead. We ate a lot of sausage in my house growing up, pulling it from the freezer where it was packed in bulk in my grandpa's black and white checkerboard bags. He made only three kinds: a spicy Italian dotted red with paprika and cayenne, a sweet Italian studded with plump fennel seeds, and a liver sausage that my dad wouldn't allow past our doorstep. After reading Little House in the Big Woods, I asked Papa if he would make the breakfast sausage like Ma Wilder made, seasoned with salt and pepper and with dried sage leaves from the garden.
And that's our guest, Cara Nicoletti, reading from her new book. It's her first book. It's called Voracious, A Hungry Reader Cooks Your Way Through Great Books. So here you are, a little girl, pretending to be part of this novel and, yeah. and carrying this gigantic pig on your shoulder. But here you are as an adult, essentially doing the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't something that my grandfather ever wanted for us.
To be butchers.
Yeah. He had three daughters and, you know, I'm not really sure if it was because he had daughters that he didn't want to pass the tradition on. But I think even if he had had sons, it's a really difficult business and he wanted more for his kids and his grandkids. So he wanted us to have a choice. He didn't really have one. And I had a choice and I still chose to be a butcher. So
Is he still alive?
He is. He just turned 86 a few days ago. And we're really close. And
is he proud of you?
He's so proud of me. Yeah, I actually just got a really sweet email from him this morning right before I left. He wasn't happy at first that I had chosen to do this. But now he gets a real kick out of it. And it's my family kind of goes crazy when we're together because it's all we talk about is meat.
It's meat. Yeah. You and your grandfather. Yeah. A grandfather, an 86-year-old who emails a granddaughter. That's pretty nice.
He's very with it. Seymour is very with it. He's the best.
Well, I'd love to talk a little bit more about how this book came to be because it sounds like you went back and reread some of these childhood books and books that you enjoyed as a teenager and probably as a young adult as well and then tried to figure out sort of the food in there and then to make the recipes out of the food to recreate some of these meals that you enjoyed.
Yeah. Well, I had started the blog in 2009, which had grown actually out of a supper club and a book club in my house. And that is where the book came from. But unlike the blog, which is just kind of randomly what I'm reading at the time or things that I see in the market that inspire me, this sort of has a more solid narrative line of my growth as a reader and a cook. So it was about choosing books that were really important to me at different parts of my life and making recipes for them.
Well, I turned to the chapter Lord of the Flies.
Yes.
Porchetta di testa.
Yes.
How do you make porchetta di testa?
So a porchetta is usually made of a loin and a belly sort of rolled together and spiced and roasted. But this one is made out of a pig's head. And, you know, people, for various reasons, are squeamish about that. But it's actually a really delicious dish. You debone the head and you rub it and spice it. You let it sit for a couple days and then you roast it. It's all tied up. And you slice it. You can slice it really thin and put it on sandwiches, or you can slice it in big chunks and sort of put it over lentils. It's delicious, especially in the wintertime.
Were there some books that you went back to and you thought, ooh, why did I like that so much?
Yeah. Well, Where the Red Fern Grows was an interesting one. I loved it so much as a kid. I think it was one of the first books that ever made me cry. And I reread it when I was writing the book, and it just didn't hold up for me at all. But, I mean, it's a sweet book, but I didn't remember it being as, like, graphic and gory as it is. It's kind of a strange book. But, you know, I think it's emotionally interesting. It was definitely my first tearjerker.
Well, I was also interested that you actually read Nancy Drew.
I did.
I remember reading those as a little girl.
Well, a great aunt gave them to me. So I didn't find them on my own. But I'm not really sure, actually.
Did you like them as a kid?
No, I didn't. And rereading them as an adult was interesting, too. But they kind of bugged me as a kid. And I was reading the rewritten versions. I think they were all rewritten in like the 1960s. But they made Nancy sort of more irritating because she's so perfect.
She is.
She's so
that
perfect
is irritating.
And she's
too,
so
isn't it?
Good at everything, and they're so mean to Bess, which, you know, bothered me because George is the tomboyish character. She's a girl, but usually I love the tomboyish characters in children's books, and I didn't like her. She was sort of mean spirited.
Like Scout in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah, I loved Scout. But you know, Caddy Woodlawn and even Ramona Quimby. But there was a mean edge to George that wasn't, I didn't like her quite as much.
Well, what I found interesting is reading the Grimm's fairy tales. Mm. And I remember reading them to my son and actually being horrified about what these stories were about. And
yeah.
Then, of course, putting him to bed. But finding that not scary, but you found in The Night Kitchen, you were slightly terrified
yeah.
by that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Maurice Sendak and Roald Dahl are both really good about knowing that kids need to be shaken up a little bit. And that's sort of what makes you realize that books are powerful. Whenever I would babysit and I would read books to kids, they'd always focus on the scary parts. And yeah, I mean, I think In the Night Kitchen scared me, and a lot of his books scared me because his characters are often on their own. They're away from their parents and they're in danger and they're facing monsters. And, you know, they do always end up safe in their beds again, but it's scary.
It is scary.
Yeah. It's yeah. scary as a kid, but it didn't make me love them any less, which is interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And out of the In the Night Kitchen, you made a milk thing, right?
Yeah.
It's a recipe.
It's a cake that uses malted milk and scalded milk, which it's actually a really old recipe that I found from it's from the 1800s. And I updated it and I added the malted milk. But a scalded milk cake is an old-fashioned recipe. And it's interesting because milk doesn't really have much of a taste. So, you know, if you're making just a cake with milk, that's really just a plain. But if you scald it, it has a really delicious sort of earthy flavor that comes out. It's really subtle, but it's a great cake.
Do you have a lot of cookbooks? I mean,
I do.
Shelves and shelves of cookbooks.
Yeah, but it's a pretty even split between cookbooks and regular books. I would say probably I have more novels than I do cookbooks. Yeah.
And can you read, can you taste a recipe? Like if you read a recipe and you say, oh, that would taste like this.
Oh, yeah, kind of. I mean, I think there is a way. It's interesting because reading recipes is still reading. You can find a story in a recipe just like you can find a recipe in a story. So, yeah, I mean, but there are always those kinds of recipes that you think are going to be one thing and they turn out completely different.
Yes, absolutely. Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Cara Nicoletta, and she's written a new book. In fact, it's her first book. It's called Voracious, A Hungry Reader Cooks Her Way Through Great Books. And what she did was to reread and go back to some of the books that she loved and pulled out and created recipes from the stories. And we want to hear from you. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Cara Nicoletta. She grew up around carcasses and cleavers in her grandfather's butcher shop in Massachusetts, turned to books early in her life. She went on to get a literature degree and then become a butcher herself. In her new memoir that we're talking about, Voracious, she shares some of the recipes inspired by some of the books that she has loved over the years. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. Actually, before we set up a little clip from Silence of the Lambs, I do want to talk about the recipe that you have included here. I think that will even add to the drama of what we're going to hear.
Sure.
But this is a story you liked.
It is, yeah. I liked the whole series. I read them in high school. And this is, I think, one of the most memorable food scenes. People think of it in the movie a lot, but it's great in the book, too.
Well, and I'll set this up. This is from the 1991 film by Jonathan Demme, starring Jodie Foster. She's a young FBI cadet named Clarice Starling, and Anthony Hopkins as Dr. Hannibal Lecter. He's a cannibalistic serial killer, and this is a scene during Starling and Lecter's very first meeting at the prison.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans. and a nice Chianti.
That's so horrible.
Sorry.
But you include here a crostini with fava beans and chicken liver mousse.
Yes.
That's to replace the cadaver.
The human, yeah. Well, you know, and I think that this and between this and the Lord of the Flies pig's head porchetta, I think those are going to be the two recipes that people probably have the hardest time with. But some of the most powerful food scenes in literature aren't necessarily the most appealing. And in this case, it was an interesting scene to me because he's not randomly throwing these things together. Hannibal Lecter actually knows a lot about cooking, and
yes,
Thomas Harris himself was a great cook. So these things aren't thrown together randomly. Liver and fava beans actually go really well together. In the book, it's not a Chianti. I can't remember what it is.
He says but, Chianti.
Yeah, in the book, it's not Chianti. It's something else. But either way, Chianti and whatever else he mentioned goes great with chicken liver and with fava beans. And these two, it's a fava bean mousse and a chicken liver mousse. And I think they're my two favorite recipes in the whole book. So if you can get past what they're from, you should make them.
And something like this, is this a lot of trial and error to come up with a recipe like this?
The fava bean was pretty easy because they're so delicious on their own. It really just needed a little bit of lemon and salt. And I added some Parmesan just to bring out the flavor of them. But the chicken liver mousse took me a little while to perfect. I used to make a similar one at the Meat Hook, and it sold really well. So I did kind of develop the recipe there and then, you know, scaled it down on a massive level for the book.
Used to have, or maybe you still have, people that come over, I guess, eat and then talk about books?
Yeah, I still have a book club. It's a group of about 10 girls, and we try to meet once a month and cook and eat and talk. It's not always at my house, especially lately, because there's been so much going on. But we do always try to cook things from the books and talk about them, which is really nice.
And talk about the books that mm-hmm. the food comes from.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and that's actually kind of how the whole thing was born. It originally was a book club, then it was a supper club, yeah. Then blog, then a book. So
you went to NYU. You graduated in 2008, I guess, right at the start of the Great Recession.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
Time to graduate.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
With the thought that, and you studied what's so interesting is Latin and English, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thinking, what's the Latin about? And you're looking at someone, that was one of my best subjects. You're looking at someone who actually enjoyed Latin.
Well, it actually kind of happened by mistake. I started studying Latin in middle school because we had to, and then really liked it, took it through high school. And when I went to college, I thought, I'll take a spoken language, I'll take something else. But everyone had already taken those spoken languages in high school, so even the very introductory courses were too advanced for me, and I was quickly struggling very hard. So I went back to Latin, and I ended up sticking with it even past my requirements, just because I liked it.
Just like the sort of puzzle of it?
Yeah, and NYU was enormous. There's like 40,000 kids, and my Latin class only had 6 or 7 the whole time, which was really nice. It was like a little family.
So did you think when you graduated in 08, well, I'll work in publishing, or I'll sort of be somehow part of the book world?
Yeah, that was always the hope. I thought for a minute about going and getting a PhD in Victorian literature, but things really were bad in 2008. And I was never able to have internships in college. I worked in restaurants. But even the kids that did have internships at publishing houses and magazines weren't getting jobs. So, I had to kind of figure out a different path.
So you've been a barista, you've been a server, you are a butcher, a line cook.
Yeah.
And sort of by accident, it sounds like. But it also sounds like a world that you're comfortable in.
Yeah. It was surprising to me the first time I ever stepped in a kitchen how comfortable I felt. I started at the front of the house serving and making coffee and stuff like that. But pastry was the thing that was the easiest to break into for whatever reason. I'm not sure. I think people are more comfortable with letting girls into a pastry kitchen, women into a pastry kitchen. Although I might get some flack for saying that. So I was lucky. Some chefs allowed me to come in and work an apprentice without any experience. And from there, I did baking and pastry, and then eventually butchering, which isn't as dissimilar as you would think.
Oh, really? That yeah. was sort of a question I had, which yeah. is it seems so different, you know, so
yeah.
just the texture, for instance.
Yeah, well, yeah, the texture is definitely different. I think I gravitated towards it also because it felt more feminine and cleaner, and I was attracted to that just because of what I grew up around. But they're both... I think people think about butchering as being this large-scale, brute force kind of thing, and there is a lot of that in there, but there's also a lot of precision and delicate meditation that goes into it in the same way that there is for pastry. So I didn't find them to be that different.
You have an interesting part of this book where you go to a farm. I mean, in part, it's to sort of understand how you can love animals. It seems like you do.
Yeah,
and,
I do.
And I think we all love animal stories. Mm-hmm. How you can do that and be a butcher.
Yeah. And I think that's a really valid question and something that I've struggled with, you know, and do struggle with. I love animals. And in my mind, what I do in part because I love animals and because I know that people are always going to eat meat. And if I can help it be at least in a more responsible, be done in a more responsible way, then I'm contributing something. And I myself don't eat very much meat.
Well, I was going to ask
yeah.
you that.
I, especially when I was working full time in the butcher shop, it was usually the last thing that I wanted at the end of the day. But I think also if you visit the farms and you visit the slaughterhouses and you know the farmers personally, you see how much work goes into even just raising one pig, one steer. And that makes meat feel more like a luxury than a necessity.
Oh, interesting.
So most of the time, I would say like 90% of the time I eat, you know,
fava beans, right?
vegetables and grains. I think it's important to have a little bit in your diet, but definitely we probably eat more than we need to.
And what is it about the, you know, butchering a whole animal? I actually saw a video of you, you know, hauling some gigantic thing over your shoulder. What is it about having the whole carcass there?
Well, I think it gives people the idea, it gives the customer the idea that the entire animal is valuable, not just the tenderloin. So the supermarkets will get in boxes and boxes of tenderloins. Where does the rest of the animal go? So to me, it's important that every single thing is used because it's the respectful thing to do. If you're going to eat an animal, you should eat the whole thing. And if you're going to eat a pig, you should eat its head too. So I hope people will make the recipe for the pig's head porchetta.
Besides, I would also think, I mean, a kind of strange intimacy that you would
yeah.
have by, in a sense, sort of taking an animal apart.
Yeah, you're, well, I mean, you're literally face to face with it. So if you, in my mind, if that was something that I wasn't able to do, if I wasn't able to literally face that, then I wouldn't want to eat meat. Because I think you have to be, it's good to be privy to the entire process if you're going to eat meat.
I'm looking to see if you have scars and or missing fingers or
I
anything
have some,
like that.
I have a bad one on my finger here and a pretty long one here.
Yeah.
I have
Is
a
that just
on my stomach.
Oh, do you? Occupational hazard?
Yeah, but hopefully if you're doing a good job, you don't cut yourself that much. I mean, it does come with the territory. I think I had more scars when I was baking from hot ovens than I did from butchering.
From butchering.
Yeah.
Let me quickly reintroduce you and actually say your last name correctly. Cara Nicoletti is our guest. She's written a book called Voracious, A Hungry Reader Cooks Her Way Through Great Books. She's not just a reader. She is a butcher. She's a pastry chef. She's worked in and around restaurants and food for some time now. Grew up in a family of butchers. In fact, her grandfather, her great-grandfather, her great-uncle, all of them were butchers, which is in part where she learned how to carve and also to understand that world. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Gary from South Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Gary. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I find so many similarities, and this is such a really cool conversation.
Great.
My grandfather was a butcher also, upstate Pennsylvania, and I graduated Culinary Institute back in the 70s. I came to South Philly to work, and I bought an old kosher butcher shop, which was out of business. But all the equipment was still in there when I bought the building, and it had the wooden walk-in box and the big butcher block and some hand tools, and then I got also my grandfather's hand tools when he passed away. Even though I had a lot of cousins, they decided that Gary should get these tools because he's in the trade. And I've taken down sides of beef, but the head cheese is what made me cough. I want to also know about the equipment that was in your grandfather's and uncle's shop that you used to see, as you get the sawdust on the floor and all that kind of stuff.
That's great.
Sure it was heavy.
Oh, Gary.
But, the head cheese, I was at the culinary, and the chef thought it would be funny if the Jewish guy in the class could make the head cheese. And it was a three-day process. As you know, you got to simmer the head and boil it, and then make it gelatinous and roll it and cheesecloth and the whole deal. But can you tell me about the equipment that was in the store? A little setting
sure, Gary.
I'm going to read your book.
Okay, yeah,
sure,
thanks for the
yeah,
call.
And
go
it's
ahead,
interesting.
Tom.
It's interesting because my grandfather and great grandfather, they're Jewish too. So it wasn't a kosher shop, and their home was actually kosher, so they couldn't bring any of the meat that they cut actually home to the house, which I always think is so funny. But the original shop was in the north end of Boston, and it was a really old school, you know, sawdust on the floor, only hand tools. But once that one actually burned down, and they opened another one that was a bigger facility in Newton, Massachusetts, and that one was sort of more high-tech, and it had bandsaws, and it had a rail system. People cut off the rails. It had, you know, cryo-packing machines and things like that. But a lot of the butchers were incredible. A lot of them were older Italian men, and the biggest seller for them was veal cutlets. So I remember watching the guys with the huge scimitars, enormous knives, cut very, very thin cutlets of veal. That's what I remember the most. But there was definitely big equipment in there, but I remember all the hand tools the most.
Gary, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And as you said, as a kid, it was the stinky room.
It was.
Because it just smelled like meat.
Like meat. I mean, and I think that's something that surprises people when they come into an actual butcher shop, is there is a smell. I mean, blood has a smell.
You said you've been to slaughterhouses.
Yeah.
I mean, the ones that supply supermarkets and things like that?
Well,
or?
We would visit the slaughterhouses that provide – when I was working at the Meat Hook, there were two slaughterhouses
in Brooklyn
that provided us with our meat. And we would visit them and just see the process. And
what did it look like?
These slaughterhouses were actually – it sounds strange to say, but they were incredible. They're family-run. They're all humane certified. And, you know – an animal is dying. That's the reality of it. So it's not the nicest place to visit, but the people that were running it cared really deeply about animals and wanted to make sure that they were killed in a humane way. So it wasn't the best, but it wasn't the worst.
But important to see.
Important
part
to see
of this
for
whole
me.
Process.
Yeah, definitely.
Let me get. Looks like Zach from Doylestown to join our conversation. And Zach, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're
Steve.
Welcome.
First time back in the area, so I appreciate getting to listen to local public radio around hometown again. My question primarily is about the book series by George R.R. Martin, A Song of Ice and Fire, or as a lot of TV watchers better know it, A Game of Thrones.
Yes.
A lot of us of the book readers have especially find the books very much a foodie's paradise, with the amount and descriptions of food that are in the books, lemon cakes, just suckling piglets, you know, the chicken. I mean, just the menus in the books are amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you have ever attempted to create, or have you read the books and personally found that you find those recipes to be intriguing, or maybe even equivalent medieval recipes that are, you know, especially good too?
Thanks, Zach. Yeah, go ahead,
Carl. Thank
you.
This is actually a question I get asked all the time. I read the first book. I loved it. I watched the first season of the series. There is actually a blog that focuses on all the recipes from that series, and they got a cookbook. So I didn't go into that as much just because it was territory that had already been covered. But the blog is called An Inn at the End of the Road, I think. And they have... They have a cookbook that's supposed to be fantastic. But it was the same with the Harry Potter series. There's a cookbook for the Harry Potter series. So I did leave those out. But he does write brilliantly about food out. Definitely. He can even make a squirrel sound delicious.
Zach, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You do include, interestingly, no oven required, but Sylvia Plath, The Bell Jar.
Yes.
Many of us have read that and enjoyed it.
Yeah.
You came up with a crab-stuffed avocado.
Well, I wanted to leave the oven out of it, which Was too bad because Sylvia Plath actually made a really incredible lemon meringue pie, and it was her favorite thing to make. And so I did that on the blog. But for the book, I left the oven out of it just to be safe. But that in the bell jar, Esther is working at a fashion magazine, and she goes to a luncheon, and they have these crab-stuffed avocados, and they're sort of disgusting in the book. They're covered in mayo, and they're sitting out at room temperature, and everyone gets sick from them. And that's sort of what spirals her into a breakdown, is this horrible bout of food poisoning. So I updated it so that it was actually a delicious thing. No mayo. But there's something really sort of kitschy and wonderful about a crab-stuffed avocado, 1950s-ish, which is when the book was published. Right. So
feels kind of old-fashioned
in
exactly.
a way. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's really beautiful, too. It's very colorful, and it's actually really good.
Well, we're going to take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Cara Nicoletti, and we are talking about her new book. It's called Voracious, A Hungry Reader Cooks Her Way Through Great Books. And she has lived and worked in New York for a number of years now. In fact, has a blog called yummybooks.com about her love for both literature and food. As she said, she's been hosting a supper club at her apartment, also celebrating food and literature and books. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and we want you to join us as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, Radio Times at whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break, talking with butcher, blogger, bibliophile Cara Nicoletti. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Cara Nicoletti about her new book called Voracious. We are talking about reading and cooking and eating. And you can join the conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. I remember years ago when I worked as a waitress, you could use those words back then, I used to have the most vivid nightmares about working in a restaurant and having 17 tables all at once, and I couldn't get the food out. And usually the chef or the butcher or whatever in the back was being very difficult.
Yeah,
you know.
Oh, of course.
Do you have – I don't know if there's something about working in the restaurant business that creates those kinds of anxious dreams.
Yes.
Is there the butcher equivalent of that?
Well, when I was working in restaurants, I used to have nightmares that – I could hear the ticket printer in my head, that there's a very specific noise when lots and lots of orders would come through into the kitchen. And that sort of haunted me. Butchering nightmares, not so much. I would have moments when I was cutting things on the bandsaw where my mind would wander to terrible places. But those are sort of a waking nightmare.
I would think so. Yeah. I mean, you have to pay really close attention.
Yeah,
right?
You do. You do. And I, you know, luckily never saw anything bad, or nothing bad ever happened to me, but it could very easily.
I read somewhere that you make really good sausages, or the sausages are one of your specialties.
Yeah, well, the Meat Hook is known for their sausages, so I was really lucky because I trained under a guy named Ben Turley, who's one of the owners of the Meat Hook, and
this is in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn, yes. Yeah, and he's sort of a sausage genius. And I took to it really quickly, I think because it reminded me a lot of mixing doughs. Mixing the sausage reminded me a lot of it. So I took to it. And it's nice because it's the most involved you get with creating recipes, really, being a butcher. So there was like 88 different kinds of sausage at the Meat Hook. We were creating them all the time, and they're really delicious. So there's a sausage recipe in the book, for a breakfast sausage, which is part of the essay that I read from Little House in the Big Woods.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Let me get it looks like Mike from Wynwood to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Mike. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi there. Yeah.
I know you didn't want this, but I have to contribute a professor's nightmare. Being required to teach a course which is on a subject you know nothing about.
Yes, and I took those courses in college, Mike, just so you know.
Yeah. But my real question is about the sliced turkey I buy in the deli. You know, it comes from a beautiful, almost spherical piece of homogeneous meat. That's not the way turkey comes naturally. What is done to that turkey before I get it?
Mike, thanks for the call. Do you have an answer to that, Cara?
Yeah, well, a lot is done to that turkey before you get it. The simplest answer is that usually those kinds of turkeys are pumped full of growth hormones or, you know, something that makes their breasts develop very quickly and much bigger than they should. And then usually they're glued together with some sort of meat glue so that it makes a perfect round circle, the two breasts together.
I will never look at that the same.
And, you know, the USDA says it's safe. I certainly never served it, and I don't eat it. But, yeah, a lot happens to that turkey before you get it.
Mike, thanks. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. And, again, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. I know that you've sort of taken a leave of absence from butchering. Mm-hmm. Do you imagine yourself going back? Would you like to have a butcher shop like your grandfather?
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine when all of this is over, book tour and all of that, that I won't want to get back to butchering. I'm sort of itching to do it now. It's been a long time since I wasn't working with my hands on a daily basis. So I do dream of having my own shop, whether it's whether it's a butcher shop or something else, I'm not really sure. My grandpa tells me every day, don't do it. But
why does he say that?
It's a difficult business. But, you know, buying meat, especially if you're doing it in the proper way from good farms, the overhead is very high. So it's hard to make a profit. But I would like to have my own place someday.
You have to stay in shape, though, don't you? I mean,
yeah.
I realize it's not always carrying these big carcasses around, but I would think you're still moving meat around.
Yeah, and I think also just being on your feet all day is a really particular kind of exhaustion. But it's interesting because when I was, you know, I'm never going to be a tiny, slender girl. And when I was younger, that sort of bothered me. But when I started butchering was when I came around to the fact that, like, I'm tall and I'm strong and I have big shoulders, and it's kind of incredible what you can, what your body can do. It made me like myself more,
I think, lift weights, or maybe you don't have to because you're actually doing that all day long.
When I was working, you know, the days are long and you're on your feet all day. So there's really not the option of going to the gym after work. Your feet are exhausted and your muscles are exhausted. But now that I'm not working in the shop every day, I do try to run.
So you can stay in shape.
Yeah.
I do want to read some emails here from Patricia. She says, books by Diane Mott Davidson about a caterer who solves crimes, including recipes in the books, and now came out with a cookbook. I'm not aware of that. Diane Mott Davidson.
Wow. Yeah. I've not heard of that. That's interesting.
A comment from Charlotte. I've heard that fingers have been lost in butcher shops and then ended up in meat. Is this the case?
I'm sure somewhere along the lines that did happen, maybe in bigger factories before things were regulated. But I would say not so much anymore. There's a lot of rumors that go around about what goes into sausages.
Right.
And if you're going to a good butcher shop, really all that's going in there is meat and spices and wine sometimes. But I can't speak to the big factories. I don't know.
A website comment from Dave saying there's another meaning behind Hannibal Lecter saying he ate the liver, fava beans, and wine. You're not supposed to eat those foods. Highly tyramine foods when you are on some kind of medication.
Oh.
I think he's trying to tell Jodie Foster's character that he's not taking his meds.
Oh, that's so interesting. Wow. I'm so happy that someone commented that because I, as a high schooler
reading the books,
I really didn't. I mean, to me, I thought it was because they actually go really beautifully together, but that makes sense. That's really interesting.
Question from Kevin. I believe this is Kevin, our engineer here, who happens to be a very good cook himself. I wanted to know if you have any formal culinary training also? Is your family butcher shop still open?
I don't have any formal training. I worked and apprenticed in kitchens and got my training that way. So I didn't pay for training, but I paid for it in free labor. And no, my grandpa's butcher shop closed in the early 2000s. I think he closed it on purpose before any of us could take it over.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
But he's still okay with you being a butcher
then?
He
is, yeah. He came around to it. It took him a while, but he's happy with it. I think he's happy I have writing as a backup just in case.
Just in case. Yeah. Writing as a backup. Yeah. Yes, I know. Not everyone would say that.
No.
You also include in here, and this is from the charming little book, If You Give a Mouse a Cookie. Mm-hmm. And again, I read somewhere that you make really good chocolate chip cookies. Is that true?
Well, I used to make them in the shop at the Meat Hook in Brooklyn because we always had an excess of lard.
Oh.
So I was always looking for things to do with the lard. And I would make pie crust with it, biscuits, and I would make this cookie dough, which was split between butter and lard. And in the book, I did not include lard because I think people are kind of squeamish about it. And there's already enough squeamish recipes in the book. So this is just a straight chocolate chip cookie, but the butter is browned first. And there's some flaky salt on it. They're great cookies.
Yeah. But I have the feeling, book aside, lard is something that people should be using if they want to make
I really love it's called leaf lard. It's the kidney fat on a pig, and it's suet. It's the equivalent of suet on a cow. It's really neutral, and it has a higher melting point than butter, so there's more steam release when you're baking, and that means there's more layers and more flakes, and it's a shortening, which literally means that it shortens the gluten strands. And
is that what shortening means?
Yeah. So it shortens the gluten strands, which means, you know, the longer your strand is, the tougher something is. So when it shortens it, it makes it sort of crumbly and flaky. Yeah.
And again, Cara Nicoletti, our guest, we're talking about eating and cooking and butchering and food. And again, if you want to join the conversation, that phone number 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. So we talked a lot about your butchering grandfather. Mm-hmm. Did you come from a family of good eaters and foodie type people? I mean, I'm curious about the kinds of meals that you grew up eating.
Well, it's interesting because my family was definitely really food driven and food focused, but we didn't necessarily eat gourmet things. I mean, we ate chicken nuggets and fruit cocktail, and you know, it was very normal food that we ate. But my family definitely loves to eat, and it's the focal point of everything we do. So, I mean, my dad actually made me leave my college graduation early because he was hungry and wanted to go to a restaurant. So, yes, I would say my family is definitely food focused.
That's very funny.
Yeah.
And you were in New York, so always a good place.
We were like at Madison Square Garden because NYU is enormous, and he texted me like, "Can we go eat? I'm really hungry."
Had you gotten your diploma yet?
Yes, I did, but there was still a lot to go. I was fine with it, though.
But not fancy meal? I mean, like Thanksgiving, Christmas, Thanksgiving, all that?
No, very, very basic. I mean, I had the Italian side and I had the Jewish side, so some of my favorite food is Jewish food.
Such as?
Chopped liver is my favorite food.
Oh, really?
I absolutely love chopped liver. Matzo ball soup.
Comfort foods.
Yeah. My grandpa used to make a corned cow's tongue that I really loved, like a go on a deli platter. Those are my favorite.
How about on the Italian side of the family then?
On the Italian side, I mean, we ate pasta every single night for dinner, no matter what we were eating. My dad always made a bowl of pasta to eat. But I would say that the influence was a little bit more heavily on the Jewish side, food-wise, because that side is very big. It's a big family, and everyone lives sort of seconds away from each other, so we usually
they
eat together.
They kind of won the food wars then. What is it about bacon? It seems like everywhere you look, there's bacon.
I know. Well, I think things have food, especially lately, has its own cultural moment. People were obsessed with cupcakes a few years ago, and then donuts. And so bacon has been kind of having a moment for the last couple of years. But, you know, I would say bacon is delicious, but you don't need it like in your coffee and on your donut. You know, eat it on its own sparingly if you have to.
Did you like being a barista or being a server? I mean, that part of the restaurant world?
I think that it's something that everyone should do once in their life. I think if everyone was a barista or a waitress, they would be nicer.
A better person. Yeah. I would agree with you.
Yeah, more patient. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say I liked it as much as it just taught me a lot about interacting with people and being patient mm-hmm. and working quickly.
Is there a time in a butcher shop, though, that's sort of maybe the quiet before the storm or sort of where it feels maybe at the end of the day mm-hmm. where it has a kind of atmosphere to it?
Yeah. I would do the sausage making shifts in the morning at 7 in the morning, and the shop didn't open until 10. So there were sort of 3 hours of quiet where you were just mixing and linking and stuffing sausage, and I really loved those moments. But the Christmas is insane, and it's actually really fun because everyone in the neighborhood is coming out to get their big roasts and their orders, and everyone's sort of stressed out but in good spirits. And I really like that time of the year. It's really fun.
I'm curious about your apartment in Brooklyn. Do you have – I mean, do you have a – I know what apartments in Brooklyn yeah. look like. Do you have a kitchen that's more than a closet?
I've been in my apartment for like over 8 years now. So I did get in just over the hump of when things started getting – really, really expensive 3 or 4 years ago. And it's rent controlled. So I have a nice big apartment. Wow. I used to live there with my sister and my boyfriend. And these days I'm in it alone, which is crazy.
In a rent controlled apartment in Brooklyn?
I know. Holding on
for
dear life.
Don't go anywhere.
I know. Well, all the buildings are getting bought out. So I'm hoping my landlord will stay strong. But it's a great kitchen. There's not a ton of counter space. But I get things done in it. My older sister is a cake decorator and a pastry chef too. So when we were living together, it got a lot of use.
Well, we're almost out of time here. Do you have a favorite thing you like to make?
My favorite thing to make is probably chopped liver.
Is it really?
Yeah, and I love making chicken soup also, really big batches of chicken soup and then eating it all week.
And chicken liver, just I guess you want really good chicken livers.
You want to make sure you get really good chicken livers, yeah. You don't want to buy supermarket chicken livers because livers can get you sick if they're not good quality, just like any meat. But.
Well, Karen Nicoletti, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you
yeah,
so much for joining us today on Radio Times. The book Voracious, A Hungry Reader Cooks Her Way Through Great Books. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and you can also find out how to listen to us on satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we do want to close things out with some music. We have Louis Armstrong and his All Stars, All That Meat and No Potatoes, and this is from the 1955 album. Satch plays Fats, a tribute to the immortal Fats Waller, with vocals by Velma Middleton.
What's wrong, Daddy? You look like something's bothering you.
There's nothing bothering me, honey, that a piece of roast beef can't fix up.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, Pops. A man works hard, then comes on home. Expects to find stew with that fine ham bone. He opens the door, then starts to look in.
Say, woman, what's this stuff you cooking? Now all that meat and no potatoes, I just seem right to like a green tomato.
Here I'm waiting, palpitating with all that meat
and no potatoes.
All that meat and no potatoes, all that food to the alligators.
Now hold me steady, I'm